org, and listen or download any show from the last 2 weeks. For information on subscribing to your favorite show, to download it automatically to your computer, click on the podcast help link at archive.kpft.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Have an interesting show. It's open forum. I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to first of all put out the phone number 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738, also known as 713-526-KPFT. Tonight is open forum, so I'm going to start off with several topics, but that is not what we are necessarily limiting the show to. This is kind of an interesting week, because in a couple of days, it's going to be the 70th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of France by the Allies in 1944, June 6, 1944. This was supposed to be the first day, but the weather didn't permit. We've got the Bo Bergdahl question. I don't think it's much of a question, but apparently some people do. The implications of the Bo Bergdahl situation for Republicans and Democrats, and to what extent military personnel support one or the other party when they vote. It's also the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square demonstrations, and it's called the Tiananmen Massacre. I'm going to be a little forbearant in terms of calling it a massacre, but it certainly wasn't a good thing. So the reason I want to give out the phone number so early is because of those two really big things, the D-Day anniversary and the Tiananmen anniversary. I would particularly like to invite anyone who participated in either of those events. If there's anyone listening who has firsthand experience of D-Day, who is either on the beaches or in support of the troops going to the beaches, you will absolutely have priority on your call. Also, I know there are a lot of Chinese and Chinese Americans who are currently in Houston, and I know for a fact that some of them were at Tiananmen 25 years ago. If you were there, I would love to talk to you about what it was like, what the students were after, and how things ended. First-hand account. I would be really interested. And again, if you call, I will put you ahead of other callers, except perhaps the D-Day guys. You know, then we'll have to take them in order. So, starting with D-Day, and the phone number again, by the way, 713-526-5738. D-Day veterans, Tiananmen veterans, I would love to hear from you. Otherwise, open forum. 70th anniversary of D-Day. Apparently, there is a little political tiff going on among some folks about the fact that French President Hollande invited Vladimir Putin to the D-Day celebration, or the D-Day memorial. Apparently, the Russians are not always there. They've sometimes been invited, sometimes not. They've sometimes shown up, sometimes not. One of the reasons that Hollande claims that he feels that it's valid for the Russians to be invited, as he put it, the Russians took so many casualties. Let's see. There was a note here. I take notes, but the articles are so long. Okay. Casualty ranking. Among military and civilian deaths during the Second World War in the West from 1939 to 1945, I'm not dismissing the Eastern War, but this is about the Western War. Poland lost fully a fifth of its pre-war population during the Second World War. Think about that. 20%, one in every five Poles, died in the Second World War. The Soviet Union lost an 11th of its population, so that'd be about 9%. Soviet Union, with a population of something around 100 million people, lost 9% of their population in the Second World War. France lost a 77th, about 1.5%. France lost a 125th. The United States lost a significant number of men, but much fewer. I think the total American casualties from that war, total casualties, not necessarily deaths, were something like 99,000. Actually, I think that was the number of deaths. I think casualties was higher. The Civil War was the war with the highest casualty rate, and as a percentage of the population, devastating. I think that we lost something like 250,000 people during the Civil War, of course, partly because both sides were American, but also an enormous number of civilian deaths, deaths from disease. So to get back to the point, Hollande says that since the Soviets made such an enormous sacrifice that he feels it's appropriate to at least have invited them. And of course, from Putin's point of view, he may want to show the Russian population that all's well now with the West and, you know, the thing in the Ukraine and Crimea. No big deal. No big deal. Couple of interesting notes. I pulled an article from Business Week called Putin's D-Day Landing Shows Memory Collides with Politics. That's where I'm pulling a lot of these particular specifics from. One of the quotes in the article is that all war anniversaries can be given a political meaning. The challenge is to give them the right one, said Stephen Sestanovich, a professor of international diplomacy at Columbia University and author of a book called Maximalist, A History of Postwar U.S. Foreign Policy. Quote, Putin will want Russian television viewers to see that all is forgiven. Western audiences should hear something different, that D-Day was about creating a world in which big countries can't gobble up territory from their neighbors. Of course, the word there isn't really can't. The word there should be shouldn't gobble up territory from their neighbors. Can't is kind of a different word, just English purism. The note is made in the article that during the Second World War, there were a lot of rival national interests and personal grudges among the so-called Big Three alliance of the U.S., Britain, and Soviet Union. Frankly, Stalin and Churchill hated each other. I don't know that Roosevelt was particularly fond of either one personally. It's any article on the Second World War or D-Day is potentially really, really interesting. There's a quote here from Garry Kasparov, the chess grandmaster who has turned into an anti-Putin dissident. And since the Soviet Union at that time included a lot of SSRs that are now independent countries, he wondered out loud why the leaders of Belarus, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, who were all once enlisted, as he put it, in the Soviet cause, were left off the D-Day list. This is actually a very interesting point. If you're going to invite Putin as a representative of the Soviet Union and the sacrifices the Soviets made during the Second World War, and you know, you can argue whether they set themselves up for this because they had a treaty with Hitler to divide up Poland. Nuances. But the question then arises, well, if Putin goes at the invitation of the French, he is not the representative of the only country that made sacrifices during that war. The Ukrainians certainly made enormous sacrifices in terms of the loss of people. The Uzbeks, the Lithuanians, the Latvians, the Estonians. I mean, all of these parts of the Soviet Union or territories that were occupied by the Soviets and became Soviet territory, where are their leaders? Are their leaders all there? Apparently not. So I think that while I can understand Hollander's reasoning, I don't think he followed it to its logical conclusion, and perhaps they didn't thrash it out enough before that decision was made. So, phone number, 713-526-5738. We have open lines. I think that the D-Day commemoration actually is a nice segue into the question of Bo Bergdahl. We talk about prisoners of war. Now, up until Korea, for the most part, we won our wars. So we freed our prisoners of war as opposed to negotiating their exchange. At the end of the Korean War, well, we didn't lose. We didn't quite win. We had to negotiate repatriation of American POWs from the Koreans. And I think also the Chinese, as it happened. After the Vietnam War, we had to negotiate repatriation of POWs with the North Vietnamese. So this is not a unique experience in American history. It's only historically a relatively recent one. So when you get to Bo Bergdahl, there are really two different and, in my mind, actually unrelated questions. Did he desert? Did he go over to the enemy side? Was he guilty of treason? Now, in the Constitution, treason is a very narrowly defined thing. So, for example, Egberto, help me out. The NSA leaker?
Snowden.
Snowden, thank you. So Snowden, by many, has been called a traitor. According to the Constitution, he may be many things that we think despicable, perhaps, or he may be heroic in some minds. The one thing he is not, by the narrow definition of the Constitution, is a traitor. Treason is defined in the Constitution as betraying your country during wartime, in a declared war, I might add. So that gets a little tricky. Going back to Bo Bergdahl, he may be a traitor, he may be a deserter, he may have actually thought he was defecting to the Taliban side in some misguided notion that perhaps he could act as a bridge between the Taliban and the West. I don't know. No one can know what was in his mind at this point. But the central question then becomes, do we still want to repatriate him as a prisoner of war, and then if he committed military wartime crimes, try him in a court-martial? Or do we want to try him in Congress or in the court of public opinion and decide whether he is worthy of being repatriated as a prisoner of war being held by the enemy? You know, it goes back to the old question that I first heard many years ago from David Fowler on KPRC when talk shows were, you know, not one sound. When he asked the question in the course of a conversation, do we send people to prison as punishment or do we send people to prison for punishment? It sounds like a very tiny difference in the way you put it, but it makes an enormous difference. Do you send someone to prison because being imprisoned and having your life regulated day and night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 364 days a year, do we send someone to prison because that is the punishment? or do we send someone to prison so that they can be abused by other prisoners, raped, assaulted, mistreated by guards? That would mean sending them to prison for punishment, essentially at the hands of others. So again, coming back to Bergdahl, do we leave him as a POW because we believe he should be punished by his captors? We believe that he should be a POW and imprisoned for punishment? Or do we believe that he should be repatriated, regardless of what his status may have been, and treat him either as a hero or as a deserter, but do it by U.S. military law? Egberto, you have a comment?
Yeah, it's un-American for us to have left him there. The reality is, if the concept of American jurisprudence is innocent until proven guilty, then we don't know the circumstances of his quote-unquote desertion, and as such, why would we not treat him as if he was innocent of whatever he's accused of?
Until he's tried
in a court of law, and then we act accordingly under the laws of the United States.
And this is one of the weird paradoxes of the right wing today in this country, is they keep protesting how they love the Constitution and they love America, but they seem to have problems with certain things about the America and the Constitution they love. And being innocent until proven guilty by a court of law seems to be one of those things that they have a real hard time getting their heads around, because it is very common for conservatives to judge way before there's even an indictment, let alone a trial or a verdict. We are now at 10:16 p.m. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My engineer is Egberto Willis. We are taking phone calls, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. It is open forum, even though I am throwing out some ideas in terms of what we might want to think about or talk about. We do have a caller, Catherine from Cleveland, is it?
Yes, sir.
Hi, how are you? You're on the air.
Oh, fine. I know that I'm not supposed to be knowing, but I don't. What do you mean by repatriated?
Ah, well, when you talk about being repatriated, you're talking about being brought back. So you have, and this is not spelled like patriot, P-A-T-R-I-O-T. This is P-A-T-R-I-A-T-E, and I think it probably comes from Latin, like fatherland, pater.
Oh.
Paterland, something like that. Maybe it comes from Germanic, I'm not sure, but something along those kinds of roots. So when you are an expatriate, then you are somebody who is living overseas. So you talk about expatriate Americans, people living in France or Germany or South America or whatever, expatriate Americans who are still citizens,
okay. But
they're not living here. When you talk about repatriation, generally you're talking about bringing people back, usually under difficult circumstances, or sometimes under legal circumstances. So you might have someone extradited back to the United States and forcibly repatriate him. Or you might have a prisoner of war who is being detained, and you then have negotiations like we did with Bergdahl to have him repatriated back to the United States. It's an interesting word. And it can be used with different flavors, in a manner of speaking.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I appreciate your asking. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, I like that kind of question. There is no such thing. This is my philosophy. There is no such thing as a stupid question the first one or two times you ask. There is no such thing. You cannot be held responsible for what you don't know, and I will never make fun of anybody who asks a question about something they don't know. And I thank you, Catherine. That was a great call. We have open lines, 713-526-5738. So this Bergdahl question, I think that this raises a lot of really interesting, well, I don't want to repeat the word questions, but I guess questions is one of the things it does. First of all, I think it raises an interesting question about military political allegiance. Now, in a strict sense, in a technical sense, when you're in the military, you don't have political allegiance. You don't belong to a party. You're not supposed to take political positions or make political pronouncements. You are always effectively on duty when you're in the military. If you want to make political pronouncements, you retire. That's how that's supposed to work. Nonetheless, military people vote. They may not go out campaigning. They are technically not supposed to have political discussions, but, you know, private time, that kind of stuff. But they vote. I think when you look at the current Republican positions on a lot of issues relating to the military and military personnel over like the last 15 years or so, I think that there's a legitimate question here whether military personnel should really maintain their allegiance predominantly with Republicans who are supposedly pro-defense, pro-military, pro-military spending, gung-ho, hoorah, or if in fact things have evolved to a point where if you're in the military, the people that are most on your side are Democrats. Now, of course, we're generalizing. You know, when you're talking parties, you're always generalizing. There are liberal Republicans, there are conservative Democrats, and all of this stuff. I'm going to take a phone call now. We have John from Conroe on the line. John, how you doing? You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
As far as Bergdahl goes, of course, being on Facebook once in a while, you hear, see all of these vicious comments. And my response is similar to yours. Let the military court decide. We have no idea what that young man went through prior to him going AWOL or deserting. And the second comment that I always put in is that he wasn't drafted. He enlisted.
There's that.
You know, and these guys on, well, I guess I shouldn't say the station, but you know what I'm referring to. And these are all tough guys now, talking about his father and things. Some of them were of age to join up. They didn't. So...
We call them chicken hawks. I never served. I was in a position where I might have been drafted. I was fortunate. I was not. I cannot judge people who have served.
Same thing with me. I'm 61. I've missed the lotto by just about 10, 15 numbers.
Yeah, I was just really, really lucky. I was eligible the year that the draft law lapsed. And if it had gone, this was 1972. And if it had gone forward, I would have been drafted or not, I figured, by about 15 letters. It was like, my number was like 181, and it was like 180 plus however the alphabet worked out, something
right,
like that.
Right.
And then that year, Congress decided not to renew the law until they had some negotiations with Nixon. And as it turned out, by the time it was renewed, the top number they hit was 125. So at that point, I was 1H. I had had a year of exposure. Now I was only going to be drafted in the event of a real national emergency declared war.
Just to get off the subject, because you mentioned that, and you can comment, I'll just hang up, but I've thought of for quite some time, I personally believe that the draft was stopped. So how did Eisenhower put it? The military complex could make a fortune.
I'm not going to say whether you're right or wrong, but from my limited readings, I think that the opinion that the reason that the draft was ended was so that you had a much narrower cross-section of the population exposed. And as you say, all these people are volunteers, and only 1% of the population has ever served, so people don't have a blood stake what's going on, which is one of the reasons that I've advocated before universal national service, not necessarily military service, but universal national service of some kind. And when
my father said the same thing when I was a young man. Yes.
And I
agree with that.
And you shouldn't necessarily have to serve in the military, but I think once people are in that position, many of them offered various opportunities and reasons would join the military. But I think that we have a very parochial-minded population, and I think that serving in many different capacities in many different parts of the country would be mind-expanding in a way that would be societally beneficial to us.
Yes, because then, you use the term blood stake, but you'll have a patriotic stake, perhaps.
Both.
Is the term for
perhaps
it.
Both. But certainly you would have a personal flesh, you'd have your flesh on the line. And I think that's one of the things that particularly in our subsequent wars after Vietnam, our political leadership and to some extent our military leadership decided would make war much easier politically and more of a, literally in a sense, a bloodless decision for leaders.
Yeah.
I appreciate your calling, John.
I enjoy your show, as I told your producer. I'm just very fortunate. I leave work at 10, and I catch you every Thursday.
You're the kind of guy I'm looking for.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the show. Once again, I've called before.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Take care. Drive safely. Arthur from downtown, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Hello, Mr. Koenig. How are you, sir?
Actually, it's Honig.
How's it spelled?
H-O-N-I-G. Let me tell you the problem here. We're going to digress here for a moment. Because my name is Mike Honig, it's very hard to breathe that H. I've actually had people suggest I do like the 007 thing, Honig, Mike Honig. That might work. The difference is that Koenig is German for king, and Honig is German for honey. So I like to joke that somewhere back in my ancestral line, there was probably a Honig Koenig.
Yeah, all right. I wanted to say a couple of things.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't think in terms of the term conservative, okay? I have a problem with that term. I feel like it was hijacked. First of all, I don't think of Republicans as conservative. To me, they are not conservative. They're radicals.
I think we've had this discussion, haven't
yeah.
we? I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, anyway, one of the things, too, is they're illogical. For example, with science, they're very, very happy to accept scientific principles when it's going to make them more money. If it's going to, if science comes up with a fertilizer that gets more crops, or some kind of feed that makes the cattle fatter or the pigs fatter, or something that does something where they make more money, then fine. Yeah, they believe in that kind of science, but they do not believe in the kind of science, like, for example, an inconvenient science like climate change. No, that can't be. That would cost, that would cost me money. I couldn't sell coal anymore, and I couldn't sell oil anymore because that will, because the scientists are saying that is environmental pollution, that's causing carbon monoxide in the atmosphere.
I'll make a couple of comments that basically are in substantial agreement with you. One is that they have found doing some survey recently that calling the problem global warming, which the conservatives actually really jumped on, actually global warming people find scarier than climate change. That's an interesting, it's like Obamacare is less popular than the Affordable Care Act. That's number one. Number two, talking about something like Obamacare, it's amazing to me that businesses were not more behind a single-payer system like Medicare for All, because they would be able to get all their medical costs off their bottom line, which would actually make them more competitive. So I've never understood that. I've got several other people on the line, Arthur.
Okay,
I appreciate
sure.
your calling.
Talking to you.
All right, you
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. We have callers on the line. If you're willing to wait a little bit, the phone number is 713-526-5738. We still have a couple of open lines. Our next caller is Matt from Houston. How you doing, Matt? You're on the air.
Great, Mike. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to ask a quick question, and yeah. I'll hang up. I don't want to take up too much time. Back to the Snowden issue. I know that the government, NSA, is a separate entity. It's not considered a corporation. But why would Snowden not be protected under the Whistleblower Act? Thank you.
Thank you. From what I understand, that's part of the discussion going on, and I think that the argument made by some is maybe he is, but we can't know that until there's a trial, which we can't have until he returns to the United States. You may be right, or it may be a mixture. Some of what he revealed, he may be eligible to be protected under the Whistleblower Act, whereas some of the stuff he revealed... Sorry about that. Thank you. Whereas some of the information he revealed, he may have violated contractual obligations, he may have violated oath obligations. All of these things, though, it's going to take a trial and, you know, see what indictments come down before we can really know. Next caller is Lon, I believe, in Houston. How are you doing, Lon?
Hello, this is Alon.
Oh, yes. Hi, Alon.
Yes, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Mike, I agree very much with what you're saying tonight, and you're looking into a lot of aspects that need to be discussed. And I also wanted to add a point of information that the BBC had a lengthy program on today, which I heard, and it's on their website also as Will Bergdahl Face Trial. And in the discussion of this program, they went into all the aspects of what constitutes a traitor or desertion and so forth, and what psychologically may have been going on, and they talked about his letter to his parents prior to his leaving the point of duty and that sort of thing. So just wanted to add that as a reference because it was a pretty good program and there was a lot of interesting information in it. When you are framing something, setting up the arena for discussion, so to speak, sometimes it's possible to fall into old habits that for political correctness, when you're saying the debate will come between, you know, Republicans and Democrats over this issue or whatever, sometimes it's easy by mentioning the most popular parties, it kind of lends to the perpetuation of those being the only two parties in most people's minds. So if there's an opportunity to do so, I let people know that that's not the only two political parties, and if we're ever going to get away from having just two parties, then it's good to mention that there's a Libertarian Party, Green Party, etc. So that's the only point I wanted to make. But otherwise, I agree very much with you, and check out that BBC program.
Okay. Thank you for calling a lot. Okay, Bill from Houston, you're on the air. What's on your mind this evening?
Hey, Mike. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear you advocate bringing back universal draft. Did I hear you correctly?
Well, I didn't actually use that word. What I said is universal national service, which is not the same as a draft, per se.
Okay, so universal national service. So, for example, if a conscientious objector didn't want to go to the military, he'd go, like, work in a hospital.
In a sense, the military, under my concept, in a sense, the military would still be voluntary, but you would have a choice of a variety of different things. Maybe you do hospital work. Maybe you would do construction work. Maybe you would work on Native American Indian reservations. You know, maybe you'd join the Peace Corps. You would have a whole smorgasbord of things you might be able to choose from, but you would have to do something. You would have to do something in the service of your country that would also serve as an educational experience, a growth experience, something that made you part of something more and gave you experiences beyond perhaps the parochial in your own little neighborhood.
Well, how is that not involuntary servitude banned by the U.S. Constitution?
Well,
I mean, that's slavery. I'm not here to be a resource to the state. I'm not a slave to the state. I own my own life. And it's bad enough that I have to, you know, I out of every $3 that I earn, one of them goes to Uncle Sugar. And now you want my kids to have to sign up and go do service for this state, this monstrous Leviathan that wants to dominate the entire world? No, thank you.
Well,
how is that not slavery?
Well, first of all, slavery implies that you're not being paid and you are totally at the mercy of the owner. You would not be owned and you would not be working for free. You would have benefits. You would have housing. You would have money. You would have free time.
Slaves got housing. Slaves were fed.
Slaves were not paid. Slaves did not have free time. Slaves were not given choices. all of those things would be part of the package. But also, I think that you have a responsibility to your country. And your responsibility to your country is not necessarily ended when you hand over a couple of bucks out of every dollar, a couple of bucks out of every 10 you earn or something to that effect. You have a responsibility to your country. And I think that a lot of our political problems today spring from the fact that people's minds and experiences have gotten extremely narrow. And I think that you would also see this as an educational experience, because you would get to see things and do things and meet and know people that otherwise you would never get to know. And in my life, when I have done that either voluntarily or due to circumstance beyond my control, I have come back from that feeling like my mind and my experience have been dramatically expanded, and it's given me a whole different world perspective. And wouldn't you want that for your kids?
Well, I spent 12 years in public school associating with people in a government-run propaganda youth camp. Let's face it, that's what they were.
As opposed to the privately owned propaganda schools?
They felt free to inflict violence and discipline on us. We had no choice. And you just want to give us two more years of that kind of BS. I hate it, man. I just want to do my own life and have everything. I want it to be voluntary.
Do you voluntarily pay taxes? Do you voluntarily obey speed limits? Do you voluntarily pay for things?
Give up 2 years of their life in service to the state. I'm tired of being a slave to the state.
Well, you're not a slave to the state. You're a citizen of a country, and every country has rules, and every place has rules, and every life has rules. When you lived in your parents' house, you had rules. You were a slave to your parents. I
yeah,
think
government's not my father. I'm a free man in a free country.
You're a free man in a.
I don't want to go back to slavery.
You are
in
a country.
If you want to hire, if you want their labor, pay them.
They will be paid.
Association that's mutually beneficial.
It will be mutually beneficial.
You must do this. Now, here's what I could get behind.
Okay.
I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what I could get behind.
Okay.
If you want to have, you know, service to your country, I'd say, okay, fine. 2 years in the military or alternative service, and if you complete that, then you become a citizen, and then you can vote. But just being a mouth breather, uh-uh.
Well, now, you see, from what you just said, actually, we're not that far apart, in spite of this whole argument we've been having. We're really not that far apart. We're like a little quibbling on the details, but we're both saying the same thing.
Well, I mean, the people...
You see, now
we've been
getting at each other... No, this is funny.
We people who should be allowed to vote. The rest of us, we don't have a voice.
But Bill, this is
any skin in the game.
This is part of a bigger picture. You and I have been going at each other, and actually, we agree, except for a couple of minor talking points.
Those are major stumbling blocks.
It depends on how you look at it. I appreciate your call, Bill.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye bye. I find that so interesting. That happens so often. People are going at each other, and it's like, oh, but when you get right down to it, we actually agree 90%. Egberto?
Well, you know what is so interesting? That the young man who just called, when he all this rage he has against government, he doesn't realize in a true democracy, government is all of us.
But the point is, we agreed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we might disagree on what constitutes your right to vote and when you should have it. That's certainly an important question, but we were in agreement on the central question in that discussion. It's just very weird. I want to go to Steve in Spring. Steve, how you doing? You're on the air.
Great show. I tell you what, if you were over in Tiananmen Square when this happened 25 years ago, they probably would have killed you for expressing the views that we've expressing tonight. This is a great discussion.
I totally agree with you. And I want to remind callers, if you were any kind of a participant in D-Day, and if you were any kind of a participant in Tiananmen, pro or con, student or medical support, whatever it was, do please call the show and let Egberto know so I can give you priority to get on. We haven't talked much about Tiananmen. I want to get to that before the show ends. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, sir. I just want to say that I tell you what changed my life. When I was a teenager, my parents, my dad was in the military. He was actually down in Havana, Cuba with the U.S. Navy, and they were in a little bar over there. And a lot of the casinos were run by the mafia at that time. And
pre-revolution.
Exactly. And they said, there's a man up in the mountains going to come down and liberate the country and overthrow Batista. And then that's what happened, Fidel Castro. So history repeats itself. And also, I had my stepfather was in Vietnam. He flew 171 recon missions. And I tell you what, this is what they say. There's about 8 burials a day over at Arlington. They say school children go in there, you know, being school children, they leave, and it's totally, as it did with me, and anybody that goes there and sees that and see all the tombstones for miles, the Changing the Guard and the Eternal Flame and the Kennedy Memorial and everything. It will totally change your life and perspective. It will give you patriotism. And you know, when you're a child and everything, you read about it in books, but when you see it in person, you're just completely floored. I mean, it's a very moving experience. And I just want to thank our vets for their service. If they've, you know, have served or are serving right now, because without them, we wouldn't have the freedom to be able to say what we're saying on your show tonight.
I appreciate that, Steve. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
To go back to sort of that topic, I want to point out that I think some of the most important experiences I've had, good or bad, the ones that perhaps I had no choice in whether I wanted to experience them, those are the things that have probably changed me the most and expanded my perspective on the world the most. And even some of the bad things, I would have to say I would not change them because of what I learned from them. So we still have some open lines and some time, 713-526-5738. Still waiting for somebody to call about Tiananmen. I really want to talk about that. Gary from Houston, you're on the air. How you doing?
Okay, I just wanted to say the biggest problem with politics today are these meaningless terms, this false dichotomy. I don't know if it was Will Rogers or Mark Twain, or he was asked, or are you a conservative or a liberal? And he said, what's the topic? I mean, how can any human be 100% conservative or 100% liberal? These terms have no meaning whatsoever. I mean, I'm liberal on certain things and conservative on other things, depending on the terminology. It's like saying, are you a Wookiee or an Ewok? I mean, you see what I'm saying?
But both are furry, which makes them very much similar.
I'm more conservative than you. I'm the most conservative of all. But what are you saying? I mean, it makes no sense.
Well, you know, certainly you're right. On the other hand, I think because we're not a parliamentary democracy, you don't really have single issue parties. You have umbrella parties. So I think that it becomes an issue of predominantly one or predominantly the other. I consider myself very much a social liberal, even a socialist in some respects. On the other hand, I am somewhat of a fiscal conservative or a fiscal pragmatist. I'm also sort of pro-military, but that means that I'm not necessarily for every war, everything the military does. So you're right, it gets complicated.
Well, it just has no meaning. It's not that it's complicated. Now, about Tiananmen, I was reading today that in Hong Kong, they had a major demonstration.
Yes.
They even had an artificial tank, and they reproduced, where the guy was standing in front of the tank, the famous scene.
The Tank Man.
Yeah, and that was... So the world has not forgotten Tiananmen. It's only in China, and that is a mystery, how you can be a capitalist nation and a communist nation simultaneously. That's the strangest thing I've ever seen. The government controls everything you think and do, and they control the Internet, and they control the newspapers, and yet they're going full bore with their businesses and capital. It's a strange situation, is it not?
Well, having been to China a couple of times, and again, this is one of those things where your predisposed beliefs become challenged, because what you've learned and thought all your life, you go and you face the reality, and it's more nuanced. I came away from China. One of the opinions that I found I had was that the Chinese people and the Chinese government have kind of come to an unspoken agreement. And the unspoken agreement is the Chinese people can pretty much do or say more or less whatever they want, as long as those things don't involve criticizing in any way the government and don't involve embarrassing the nation of China. And as long as you follow those two rules, it's amazing what you can get away with. I mean, it's fascinating. In China, there are places where there are no stop signs, there are no lights, and somehow people drive and you don't see highway road rage, you don't see people gesturing obscenely. It's really quite remarkable. Of course, pedestrians kind of cross at their own risk. It's like traffic laws or suggestions. It's a place that really you have to experience to believe. It's just not like what you would envision.
And one last thing. You mentioned the fatalities, the loss of life in Poland and other countries during
Yes.
World War II.
Yes.
You didn't differentiate between the people that were sent to Auschwitz and the people that went and fought the war.
No, I did not differentiate because I didn't have that information. I also did not differentiate between fighters and civilians.
I'd say half the people of Poland that were lost were probably Jewish.
That's probably true because the Jewish population in Poland was the largest in Europe.
That's right. Well, thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much. Okay, we still have a couple of open lines, 713-526-5738. It is open forum. We've been talking about mostly things like D-Day and military service and Tiananmen and Bo Bergdahl and some other things. Chris from Houston, you're on the air. I appreciate your being patient and holding. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. How are you doing this evening?
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. I just wanted to address a few of the comments the gentleman was making about the indentured servitude that national service would be. And it seems to me that a lot of history revisionists just lack the ability, or I'm not accusing this gentleman of this, but a lot of these off-the-grid, the state is a monster kind of guy, independent, I'm going to go it alone, who needs this? I just don't understand. Have they never been to a national park? I mean, every lake in Texas is a construct of, you know, national service on some level or another. Look what FDR did with the forestry campaign and things like that. We still have electrical cooperatives here in the rural areas of town. I mean, I don't know. Some of these guys have a very narrow field of vision. I think you're right. I think some national service, you know, would be a really enlightening experience for a lot of young people. We lack skilled trades. We are importing skilled trades by, you know, from everywhere that we can. And that was something that was taken care of in-house.
I think one of the great ironies in recent history is that the Martin Luther King statue memorial was made in China. And for me, the killer, white stone. I've just never understood that. Made in China, American hero with his own national holiday, a black man carved in white stone. What's wrong with that picture?
I'm sure the bottom line was great, though. I'm sure once you worked it all out, and as far as when you got down there, the bottom line, it was a great buy. I'm sure it was a terrific buy,
and that's what made all the difference. Thanks so much for calling, Chris. I appreciate it. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. The number we have open lines is 713-526-5738. I want to at least spend a little time talking about Tiananmen, and then I'm going to ask, and then I'm going to go to David, who's patiently holding. Thank you so much. 25 years ago, June 4th, Chinese troops, and I'm reading now from an article, and I don't remember what paper it's from, but I'm reading from an article by Tom Milinowski. June 4th was the day the Chinese troops put down the student-led protests in Tiananmen Square, ending hopes that China would join the changes sweeping the world. He points to at the time, East Germany, Chile, the Berlin Wall. I mean, it was just like this period of about 2 or 3 years. And he makes the point that looking back on the Tiananmen movement, it is striking, he says, how modest the protesters' demands were. An end to press censorship and restrictions on demonstrations, and openness about the income of state leaders and increased funding for education. The reason I would love to have someone who knows about the movement call is I would like to expand on that. But those would be very modest demands, and I think it was more the imagery that the Chinese leadership was afraid of, perhaps, than the specific demands. Maybe they were a little bit afraid of, you know, getting the foot in the door and the crisis, as they call it, of rising expectations. I know that there are people in Houston who were in Tiananmen at that time, and I am hoping that they will call 713-526-5738. If not this week, next week. You know, you might have to think about it. You can call anonymously if you wish. You can give a different name or no name, and I will understand that. But if you were there, I would really love to talk to you. David from the Woodlands, you're on the air. How you doing?
Good evening. This is some information I just came across. The actually videotape is called The Prize, based on Daniel Vergen's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. It was about the epic quest for oil, money, and power. it generated from the beginning of man's quest for oil and the warfare that took place in World War II, even in the early beginnings, late beginnings, 19th, 20th century. And Hitler's demise was about oil. He tried to generate a man-made oil.
Yes.
And they had
liquefied coal, essentially.
Yeah, they had the science down, and they were trying to generate the oil for the aircraft, for the military. At the very end of the war, even they had significant jets to supply the warfare to their cause, but which was what I consider this epic novel generated to a video form is look it up and see how things have happened in the world from then to now to begin this warfare, to end this warfare, to change the world. The great man that went and fought in World War II were to demise an epic change in the world.
Can you tell me?
Hitler's rise and fall was about oil for his demise. He went and looked for it in East Africa, where we already found it in 1938 in Saudi Arabia. That's what he was looking for in his warfare over there.
Do you want to give us the name and author of that book so that we can kind of have it on the record? Do you know it offhand?
It's called The Prize, and it's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. His name is Daniel Jurgens.
J-U-R-G-E-N-S?
Y-E-R-G-I-N-S.
Oh, anglicized. Okay.
Perfect generation of information for everybody to knowledge themselves about warfares and today's warfare. So,
well, I think that wars historically are fought for at least one of two reasons. The ego of the leader, power, grandiose visions, or resources. And the kinds of resources people fight over change over the ages, but it's always about resources. You know, maybe it's about water, maybe it's about food, maybe it's about oil, maybe it's about natural gas. The resources that societies need change. I mean, you bring up some really, really interesting stuff. One of the big problems, one of the big concerns that the West had when the Japanese took over Southeast Asia was that Southeast Asia was the source of most natural rubber. So that's why they had things like rubber drives, tire drives, turn in your old tires so that you could recycle them, and they didn't come up with any kind of a useful synthetic rubber until well into the war. The Germans, they had the Romanian oil fields, Ploiesti, I think they were called, and they kept trying to hold them, and the Allies kept trying to destroy them. And the jet fighters, the ME-262s, they didn't build enough of them, and that was largely because of Hitler's mistakes of judgment. And then when they did have them, they didn't have enough of them, and as you point out, they didn't have enough fuel to fly them adequately. So, yeah, fuel, in many respects, was Hitler's biggest challenge. And today, I think it's apparent that countries are still fighting wars. You know, China, a lot of this issue. Are you still there, by the way, David?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
With China, a lot of what's going on now in Southeast Asia and East Asia is not about tiny little islands, some of which barely break the surface of the ocean. It's really about the resources and the resource zones that would then accrue to countries that have a strong claim to them. So China isn't after these tiny little Daiku Islands, I think they're called. They're after the resources that lie underneath them. There's another set of islands that don't even break the water surface. And by legal definition internationally, they're not really considered islands. And China's claiming those. And really, it's all about resources, whether it's fishing or petroleum or natural gas or whatever. All of this stuff. If we see war in Asia in the next 50 years, it's going to be about resources more than anything.
I agree.
I appreciate your calling, David.
Great information and great subject matter.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. You take care. Okay, we have probably not enough. I guess if you want to take a shot and make a phone call, we might get you on the air, 713-526-5738. Let's see. What do we want to go to here? Well, let's talk a little bit more about this. An article in the Financial Times, China stealing a strategic mark on the U.S. Subcaption, bit by bit, Beijing is creating new facts, and with each incident, it throws down the gauntlet. A couple of excerpts from the article. In recent weeks, Beijing has picked simultaneous fights with Vietnam, the Philippines, and Japan, moved an oil rig near Chinese-controlled islands claimed by Hanoi. So Chinese-controlled claimed by Hanoi, triggering anti-Chinese riots in Vietnam in which four people died. This week, a Chinese fishing boat was accused of sinking a Vietnamese fishing boat. China has also antagonized Japan by flooding disputed areas of the East China Sea with aircraft and boats. It is challenging Japan's administrative control of the Senkaku Islands, known as Diu by Beijing, and I think I'm pronouncing that similar. And this has also led to a situation where Shinzo Abe, the right-wing prime minister of Japan, is now, it is remarked, may now be given the excuse he needs to press for a reinterpretation of Japan's pacifist constitution, where Japan is not only permitted to fight in its own defense, but also permitted to fight in the defense of its allies. That's really like a whole new thing. And, of course, what's interesting is, as reviled as the Japanese still are in East Asia, there are a lot of countries now, like the Philippines and Vietnam, who are thinking this may not be a bad idea because we're more concerned about China at this point, a resurgent China, than a resurgent Japan. You know, I remember there was a show called That Was the Week That Was, and they did a little sketch on the coming of World War III, which at the time didn't seem so far-fetched. And I remember one of the jokes, I've looked for this audio clip, but I can't find it, but it went something to the effect of, the newsreader is saying that the United States and its allies, Germany and Japan, fought against the opposite alliance formed by France, Britain, and China. And it was just, you know, when you look at that, how history turns things, turns assumptions and pre-existing beliefs on their heads. Who would have thought in 1946 that we would consider Germany and Japan two of our strongest allies? I mean, it's insane. Just generations change, and it seems like we all have to relearn the same lessons over and over again. Well, it's about that time. I appreciate the callers. I think it's been a fun show. I hope we can do something like it again next week. I'll look forward to having you folks call and some new ones, too. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston with my engineer, Egberto Willis. And remember, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Have a great week. I'll see you next Wednesday.
The case of the Cuban Five and the appeal to bring Alan Gross home will be the focus of the discussion by James Thompson in an event sponsored by Pax Christi Houston, Mary Knoll Fathers and Brothers and Dominican Sisters of Houston. Alan Gross is a Jewish American who is imprisoned in Cuba. There are three remaining members of the Cuban Five who continue to languish in U.S. prisons. This talk explains why it would be beneficial to both countries if an exchange could be negotiated. The Catholic Church's potential role in bringing about such a trade will also be discussed. The events happen Friday, June 6th at 7 p.m. at the Mary Knoll House, 2353 Rice Boulevard in the Rice University area. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston. If you're a regular listener to KPFT, no doubt you've heard our fund drives. This hour, you can reduce fund drives with one simple step. Sustaining members make a convenient, ongoing monthly contribution, which means less mail, no renewal notices, and uninterrupted status as a KPFT member. Sustaining membership is an easy and efficient way for you to support the programs you rely on through secure, automatic monthly payments from your credit card, debit card, or bank account. This means we'll deduct your designated contribution from your account until you let us know to stop or change it.
And the more sustaining members KPFT has, the more regular revenue and less need to interrupt programming for fund drives. Just visit kpft.org now to be a sustaining member. Make a difference right now at kpft.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
May contain language or imagery that may be offensive to some listeners. Discretion is advised. The Federal Communications Commission